1981, our Olympic moment. Throw a strike, you bum! The game. Chicago White Sox 9, Milwaukee Brewers 3 at Comiskey Park in Chicago, Illinois. 51,560 fans in attendance. On Tuesday, April 14th, 1981. The weather, sunny and 50s. Hall of Famers, Brewers center fielder Paul Molitor, shortstop Robin Yount, pitcher Raleigh Fingers, and catcher Ted Simmons, and White Sox manager Tony La Russa, catcher Carlton Fisk, and outfielder Harold Baines. Game highlights. The excitement in and around Comiskey Park was the highest it had been in recent memory. Earlier that afternoon, every fan in every bar within walking distance of Comiskey was glued to the TV, anxiously watching the historic conclusion of the first space shuttle mission, Columbia. They then filed into the ballpark to celebrate their new team. In just 3 months since taking over, owners Jerry Reinsdorf and Eddie Einhorn had quickly overhauled the roster, adding some big names with big bats and big paychecks. Designated hitter Greg Bull Luzinski and catcher Carlton Pudge Fisk headlined the list of off-season acquisitions. The two had made a combined 11 All-Star Game appearances between 1972 and 80 for Philadelphia and Boston, respectively, and did not disappoint this opening day against the vaunted Brew Crew. The Bulls' two-run single in the third and Pudge's grand slam in the fourth signaled to fans a new day had arrived. Quote, "Some people collect diamonds, and some people collect sports cars," wrote Robert Marcus in the next day's Chicago Tribune. "Carlton Fisk collects cities." The All-Star catcher who owned Boston for 9 years took possession of Chicago Tuesday with a grand slam home run in the fourth inning that turned the White Sox home opener into a 9-3 romp. Unquote. The crowd cheered so long, Fisk was forced to take a curtain call, something that never happened in all those seasons in Boston. The story. The most memorable thing about opening day 1981 was not who was on the field in front of us, but rather who was in the row in front of us. David Israel. You won't find David Israel's name on most top 10 lists of great sports writers. That might be because he walked away from the craft when he was only 30. In the minds of two 20-year-old Notre Dame sports writers, Craig Cheval and me, Israel might have been the best in the business in 1981. I got a healthy dose of Israel's writing style during his time in the late 70s at the Washington Star. In fact, when the Star shared the photo of my "Go Senators!" exclamation point banner after opening day 1977, it appeared just below Israel's insightful column about Jim Palmer and the Orioles. Craig, who introduced me to Harry Carey and his hometown White Sox 2 years earlier, had feasted on Israel's work earlier at the Chicago Daily News from 1973 to 75, and more recently, the Chicago Tribune since 1978. In an era before sports writers were able to double as TV personalities on cable channels or host their own podcasts, being a syndicated columnist was as good as it got. That meant for every piece he wrote for the Tribune, Israel would get paid a little something from each of the many other papers around the country that would print the same article. His direct, unapologetic, colorful writing earned him stature. By early 1980, it also earned him and the Tribune a privileged seat near the front of the makeshift press box in the tiny hockey arena in Lake Placid, New York, covering the U.S. Olympic hockey team's stunning progress to and through the medal round. He was only 28 years old. More than 40 years later, his social media profile picture is a relic of the Miracle on Ice win over the Soviet Union. CCCP number 20 sweater of Russian netminder Vladislav Tridiak. Considered the greatest goalie in the world, Tridiak was pulled from the Miracle game after just one period by coach Viktor Tikhonov, a move he later admitted was the biggest mistake of his coaching career. Israel's Twitter profile lists his two current roles in Hollywood, writer and producer, plus only five pieces of his past: chair, California Horse Racing Board, LA Coliseum Prez, LA Olympic exec, newspaper columnist, DC, Chicago, LA, Lake Placid witness. Fellow members of the news media remember him as more than merely a witness. Like Israel, Hubert Mizell was a giant in his craft in this golden era of sports writing. Before retiring in 2005, like so many of his contemporaries, he ranked the Miracle Game as the greatest event he ever covered. While reflecting on that historic event a quarter century later, he singled out a certain sports writer from Chicago. "The media had a section in the stands," Mr. Mizell told his Tampa Bay Times colleague Dave Schreiber. "We're all schooled to be neutral observers, but David Israel stood up in his seat, put his back to the rink, faced us all in press row and said, 'Gentlemen, there will be cheering in the press box.' And there was. It was just amazing." Clearly, Israel's unabashed approach to writing was sometimes evident in his approach to life. On this opening day, we would witness it firsthand. Thanks to the prominent photo that accompanied his work in the Tribune, Israel had an unmistakable look that included a ginormous crop of dark hair. Imagine our shock when he and some friends filed into the row directly in front of ours along the third baseline. Following a patriotic pregame ceremony and national anthem, the flag-waving fans took their seats while White Sox starter Ross Baumgarten took the mound. Brewers leadoff hitter and future Hall of Famer Paul Molitor took the first pitch for a ball. Without a moment of hesitation, Israel rose from his seat, faced the pitcher's mound, and yelled, "Throw a strike, you bum!" Love this guy. This was our Olympic moment. While it paled by comparison to the historic events in Lake Placid or the global significance of the next Olympics chapter of David's life, it was memorable for us, even decades later. For the record, Molitor singled, but Milwaukee did not score until the fifth. The bum, Baumgarten, threw plenty of strikes the rest of the afternoon, pitching into the ninth to earn the win. Nearly 40 years later, I reconnected with Israel, thanks to the wonders of social media. David shared what details he could remember of this opening day. Craig and I were not among them. His friendship with Baumgarten, and the next Olympic moment of his life that would play out in 1984. Opening day 1981, it turns out, was Israel's farewell to Chicago. He would soon leave for Los Angeles, where he would write a cityside column for the Los Angeles Herald Examiner while beginning a career in Hollywood. Accompanying him to those seats at Comiskey Park that day was, among others, Chicago Tribune sports editor George Langford. "Neither Langford nor I were used to sitting in the stands," he recalled, "so it was kind of a novel experience." The heckling of Baumgarten was more good-natured than it appeared. "Ross actually was a friend," he shared in an email. "And later, his brother Craig was involved in my career in Hollywood." "I remember nothing about the game," Israel admitted. "It led to a long night at the Palm afterwards." This might have been influenced by enthusiastic beer vendors at Comiskey or attentive bartenders at the high-end Chicago restaurant. That long night was hosted by his good friend, Bill Veeck, who less than 3 months earlier had sold the White Sox to Einhorn and Reinsdorf for $20 million. David's memory of his next Olympic moment, however, is crystal clear. It came in 1984 when he was serving as chief of staff to Peter Ueberroth, president of the Los Angeles Olympic Organizing Committee and future commissioner of Major League Baseball. Israel described it as, quote, "the only thing remotely resembling a real job I ever had in my life." Months after the U.S. humiliated the Soviets in Lake Placid, President Jimmy Carter elected to boycott the 1980 Summer Olympics in Moscow in response to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. 4 years later, there were rumors the Russians would retaliate and influence other communist nations to do the same by boycotting the 1984 Summer Olympics in Los Angeles. On the morning of May 8th, Israel and Ueberroth were at the United Nations in New York for the beginning of the cross-country Olympic torch relay when they learned the Russians weren't coming. Peter Ueberroth immediately did two things, Israel recalled. He contacted the White House, and he called the office to have them book a private jet to fly us from LaGuardia to National Airport in D.C. as soon as possible. That afternoon, Peter met with President Reagan, and I met with Mike Deaver and Bill Sitman, Deputy Chief of Staff and Assistant Chief of Staff to the President, respectively. Thus was hatched a plan to keep as many of the Soviet satellites in the games as possible. Soon thereafter, Ubaroth and I went to Cuba to meet with President Fidel Castro and his principal deputies, to no avail. But other trips were more successful. Romania and Yugoslavia both participated. So did China. Communist countries that were energy independent and did not rely on the Soviet Union for financial assistance participated. It worked out for them. Romania won 53 medals, China 32, and Yugoslavia 18. In total, they won 42 golds. Close quote. It worked out for the USA as well. The Americans racked up a total of 174 medals, 83 of them gold. The general reaction of the American people to the Soviets? Go ahead and strike, you bums! For the box score and play-by-play, visit openingday5050.com.